Welcome to the Manitoba Ag Days podcast, where we hear from some of the most relevant, up-to-date, informational speakers in our industry. In episode 35, Dennis Lang, Provincial Pulse Specialist at Manitoba Agriculture, tells his story. Soybean variety selection. A soybean is no longer a soybean.
Together, I wanted to look at a few different aspects of soybean production. These are some of the topics I'm going to cover here today. I want to talk a little bit about the growth of the industry in Manitoba, just to kind of show you how soybeans have really changed over the last 10 to 15 years. I'm going to spend some time on yield data, because there's always questions about how do we pick a variety. I'm going to talk about things like IDC, extend some seed quality issues that we may have coming forward in 2018. And just kind of finish off with some seed treatment and soybean aphid information as well. So here's an interesting map here. On the left-hand side here, you'll see the harvested acres of soybeans in Manitoba in 2011. Most of those were concentrated in the kind of what I call the traditional soybean area in the Red River Valley here. Moving forward, if we were to look at how many acres were in that area, or what percent of the acres were in that area, in this slide, it should actually be 95% of the acres that year. We're in that Red River Valley area. If you look at it this year, 2017, we only have 50% of the acres in the Red River Valley or in that traditional area. It's actually spread throughout the province quite dramatically. This slide here just shows you the progression of acres. Again, one of the big things we talked about this morning in the production panel is 2004. We had no summer in 2004. We had frost in August. We had early frost in September, 8 bushels per acre average. Acres dropped in 2005, and Roundup Ready kind of started in that 2003-2004 range. We've had a couple challenging years. 2011, you'll notice here that the yield was only 26 bushels an acre in 2011, very dry in July and August, and that's what brought those yields down. We've also had some real good successes as well in soybean production. 2013, we broke a million acres, and we also broke a record of 39 bushels an acre. In 15, we tied that record for yield at 39 bushels an acre, just over 1.2 million acres. And then moving into 16, 1.6 million, and again, breaking another record, 42 bushels an acre. So moving into this year, when you look at a 10-year average, we're looking at 35, just to give you an idea where we're at for 10 years, and 5-year average, we're at 38. But in 2017, our provincial average is going to be right around that 34 bushel per acre range, mainly just due to the dry conditions in July and August. I've got together some weather maps. You've seen some of this stuff earlier today, but some interesting stuff when you look at this. In 2016, provincial average 42 bushels per acre. And when you look at the rainfall amounts in most regions of the province, you'll see here we're well above 125 millimeters of rainfall during that July-August time period. Moving on to 2011, during that same time period, July and August, rainfall amounts were dramatically lower, especially up in that Starbuck area where they were looking at only 20 to 40 millimeters of rain. So, big challenge in soybean production. 2017, not as bad as 2011, but you can see here, especially down through the Altelier-Emerson area here, we were down to less than 60 millimeters of rainfall during that time period. If it wasn't for that residual moisture we had the year before, the yields might have been a lot lower. So the biggest point to take from that particular slide is that we can grow soybeans in most regions in Manitoba, and they are generally very successful, but they're always, you know, if you ever run into those drier years, that's when you're going to see the lowest yields showing up, other than the frost, of course. And fortunately, you know, knock on wood, we haven't seen frost in over 8 years now in fall. So hopefully keep that trend going. This is a market share report that Crop Insurance puts together every summer based on what growers report their planted acres on. And just planted acres this year, 2.1 million acres planted. In the top 10, most of those varieties are made up of early to mid-season varieties, and there is one variety in the top 10 that is considered a long-season variety. But not really a lot of percentage difference. The number one most planted only has 8.3% market share. Meaning that there's lots of varieties for growers to choose from. So when you start talking about variety selection, one of the things we tend to talk about or like to look at is trying to look at the data. And when we're putting together these trials, what we want to do is we want to try to have as many different locations as we can. So you can see all these red circles here are where we have some of our soybean trials. And we try to capture all of the different maturity zones so we can really see how these varieties perform. Now, this is from Seed Manitoba. This is the Eastern Manitoba Roundup Ready long-term data trial. You'll see this in the guide in here. You'll along the left-hand side, those early, mid, and long-season listings are listed there to help kind of match up with what varieties you have. The variety lists are there as well. The actual days, relative days to maturity is listed. So when you're at the top of the table, those are the earliest ones. And as you move down, you'll see that those varieties get longer. And, of course, we have other information in there, things like SCN and whether it has phytophthora root rot resistant genes. And also in this blue highlighted areas is the IDC scores. And we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. So kind of talk to you about how these trials are kind of set up, just to give you a bit of an appreciation of how they're done. So some of the differences and similarities. So for the location and varieties, the Western trial that you see in the western side of the province, typically those are the early to mid-season varieties that are tested there. In the eastern sites, we tend to test all maturity groupings, but we break it up a little bit. In the what we call the core sites, we test all 62 lines. In the early sites, we test only the early to mid-season varieties, so that site only has about 50. And then the long-season sites, which are down by Rosebank and Morton, those ones only had around 20 lines this year. And the eastern, another difference between them is the, in the eastern trials that you see in that big variety description sheet, and in those trials that we have on the eastern side, those are registered and experimental lines. Whereas the varieties, when you look at the western table in the guide, those lines are basically only lines that are either being marketed. They are definitely registered, but either they'll be marketed the following year. So when you're looking at the western table, if you're picking varieties for this region here, you can be confident that that seed will be available the following year. When you're looking at some of the lines in the eastern side, some of those varieties may be still early in the production system yet. So something that's also important, all these different locations are always randomized and replicated. So then we get so we're very, very confident on the data that we get from them. So in 2017, we had 62 lines being tested in the eastern core sites. We had 22 conventional soybeans lines tested. And in 2017, there were 50 Roundup Ready and Xtend lines tested in the western sites. And then also in 17, we had a couple of sites that tested some conventional lines. We had 8 conventional lines in western Manitoba. So we're trying to expand that a little bit. So this just gives you appreciation. I wouldn't be too concerned about looking at all the varieties, but this is one of the sites in Rosebank. And this is how the plot is set up. So when you go to a plot and you want to see how these trials are all set up, first thing you'll see is on the orange bars on the left-hand side, you'll see guard rows. So on each side of the plot, we have guard rows to help protect the plots from any type of potential drift or any type of other damage that may occur inadvertently. The other thing that you'll notice here is I've highlighted three green areas here, and those green squares are the check varieties. And you'll notice that they're spread throughout the plot. We have the three replications, so your first rep is here, second rep is here, and the third rep is up here. When these plots are laid out, we want to make sure that the computer program that lays them out will never lay these two varieties the same side by side or within the row. So, for example, they're always trying to be spaced out because we want to see how to make sure there's no differences in the parcel of land that we're using. So that's the one thing when you're looking at this data. All this data has been analyzed. It's looked at all three replications. The stats are determined, and I'll show you how to interpret those stats in a moment. But this is kind of a visual that you see when you walk out to the plot. Why do we test so many different locations? Well, number one, we want to see how all these different varieties want to perform in different growing regions. That's one of the first important things. Why sometimes when you're looking through the guide, you say, well, you know, there was a trial by my place this year, and that variety trial wasn't listed in the guide. Why was that? Well, sometimes what happens is when you test all these sites, sometimes there might be problems during the growing season, either due to the weather, experimental error, might be some weed issues, some weed damage. So when we tend to review these sites throughout the year, when we get looking at the data in fall and get the analyzed data back, if we find that the variance within a particular site is too high, and typically we try to keep that under 15%, if it's over 15% and we can't explain why it's like that, then that trial typically gets tossed because it doesn't really provide any good information to you if you have a very high variation within the plot that tells you that there's something else going on besides variety performance. So this is the Eastern Manitoba single-year site data. When you're looking at data, probably the most important thing you should do when you look at the table is always go to the bottom table and you'll see something in here. In this particular instance, it says check characteristics, and you'll see something that says LSD and CV percent. The CV percent just gives you an indication how good a trial it was. Typically, it ranges anywhere from 5% up to 15%. If it's below 10, you know the trial was very even. There was not much variation within the trial. When it starts approaching the higher numbers, close to that 15% range, there might be a little bit more variation than trial. Once it hits 15, we don't typically use it. But how you would use that information to determine whether there's differences in varieties is you want to look at the LSD. And the LSD stands for least significant difference. And at each site, you'll have a different LSD. So we'll just pick Morris, for example. We highlight the check variety at 100%. And the Morris LSD in this table is 12%. So anything that is 12% or higher, we highlight in green. So you can see here that we have a few varieties that are highlighted in green. We do the same thing for anything that's 13% lower than the check. And you'll see here that we do have one variety that is, or a couple of varieties that are lower than the check. Everything else that's not highlighted is statistically the same yield as the check. So that's how you can determine whether or not a particular variety is yielding higher. And because you can do this for each location, if you did this for each location highlighted, you will probably see, you know, some varieties might perform better at one location versus another, or you might have varieties performing equally well. And I'll go into a little bit more detail or kind of summarize this data on another slide here. Lots of busy information on here. This is the mid-season soybean lines from eastern Manitoba this past year. At this particular site, these are for the red bars are Carmen, and the green bar is Morris. So if I take that LSD and put a little bar on it, what you'll see is basically what we saw before. So when you look at the red bar, if you look across and you see any of those red bars that are above that, above this LSD bar, that means those varieties are higher yielding. So we do have a couple there. We add in the Morris numbers and look at only the green bars. The LSD was 12, and again, we only have two or three. So that's something that you typically would see when you look at this data over and over again. Generally, you might only see one or two varieties that stand out at a site, but generally, they're all very similar. Same thing for the Western data, using the same thing, using the data that you have in the guide. It just so happens that the LSD for Dauphin and Hamiota just happened to be 9%, the way the stats worked out. So again, in this case, anything that is above that line typically is higher yielding, and in those sites, you can see a few of the varieties. This is where that data has been taken from, that Western data that you see in the guide. Again, what you'll notice is when you go down the table, the maturity does increase. So the earliest ones are at the top and the longest season ones at the bottom. So when I'm looking at all this data and I want to see, you know, are there actual differences, so what I did is I looked at the Western sites first, and I looked at Boise, Maine, Carmen, Dauphin, Hamiota, and Melitta. And total entries of each site is 50. So number of wines that were higher yielding than the check, and the check happens to be Reston in this case. You can see here Dauphin had the most number of wines that were higher yielding than check. And there were some sites that had no varieties that were higher yielding than the check. What about the lower yielding varieties? Well, Hamiota and Melitta were the ones that had the most varieties that were lower yielding than the check. Now, what about the extend lines? Because we have a lot of extend lines in there. How did the extend lines do this year? Well, this next bar here is, or column here, is the number of lines that were higher yielding, the extend lines that were higher yielding than the check. So in Dauphin, we had two, but the other sites were either one or zero. So again, comparing very well to the check, but not really out yielding. And in Melitta here, for the ones that were lower yielding than the check, we did see 12 lines in Melitta that were lower yielding extend line than the check. Did the same thing for the eastern sites. We had 62 lines there, and you can see here by these numbers here, that, you know, really not a lot of numbers that were higher yielding than check. A couple that were lower yielding, but again, this is all from single site year data. And with the extend lines, kind of the similar trend, relatively low numbers when it comes to higher yielding varieties that are extend lines that are higher yielding than the check. So when you put this all together and then you start looking at the long-term data and put the and for this information, what you'll see is that when you start looking at those early season lines, and when you're comparing to a check, it happens to be 33003 and how the guide is put together, you got varieties that are really maturing early, anywhere from 7 to 13 days earlier than the check, which is good for growers in the western side of the province. But you do give up some yield potential. As you go down, the ones that are highlighted in green are the ones that are actually above 100% or equal to 100%. So you can see here, as you start getting longer maturities, you'll start to see more varieties maybe yielding a little higher. The other thing that's important is you look at the number of site years here too, and this table is sorted by number of site years. So you'll see here that some varieties have 30 site years, and a site year is a location year. So typically we'll have, let's say, five site years in a growing season. So if you have 30 site years, that means it's been growing over six different growing seasons. So the more information you have, the more site years you have, the more confident you are in this number here, the yield data. And the same thing here, this is getting some mid-season lines. You can see here quite a number of lines that are higher yielding. So one of the things I also wanted to do, because I do get a lot of questions on this, is there's a program on that crop insurance has. It's called Management Plus, and you can go into the variety the variety listing section of that, and you can look at and to see how the varieties did from a farmer's perspective. So the information that's in here is based on harvest production yields that you put in. So what I thought I would do is I would look at something, because I get this question all the time. So what this graph is showing you, this is a graph comparing off-patent Roundup Ready 1 varieties, which are the ones in green, to the most popular grown varieties in Manitoba. The bars indicate the average number of acres from 2013 to 2017, and this line graph indicates the yield of those varieties. So when you look across here, you'll see, you know, a number of different lines that you guys may have been familiar with, and this comes from that online publication. And you can see here with these off-patent lines compared to the more popular varieties grown, which are the top three in each year, that there is definitely a significant yield rate with those varieties. Why that is? Well, that's what the data shows. I won't explain why that is. But it's an interesting concept when you start looking at this information to see, well, you know, there are some differences, definitely. So I won't get into the legalities of this whole thing. All I'm going to say is that this came in the mail here back in the wintertime from Monsanto talking about the risk of being run seed. You may have gotten that. And there's some interesting information they put in there, but that's something for the courts to decide. So this is the field in South Dakota, glyphosate-resistant kochia. You think, wow, you know, this is a big problem. We don't have that here, right? Yeah, we do. Just not quite as bad. So this is the field from this year here. So we do have some fields, and we're seeing more and more every year of glyphosate-resistant kochia. In this particular instance, that field hadn't seen soybeans before, but it was in an area where potentially they could have had seeds wash in. So, and again, in this field, we were seeing a lot of the low areas. But this field was sprayed three times with glyphosate, and as you can see, it didn't kill it. So that moves into the extend talk. You know, we talked about, you know, how we tested the lines this year, and there were some extend lines that were a little bit higher yielding, but generally they're all very comparable to what we're currently growing. Soybeans no longer a soybean. We have extend dicamba tolerant soybeans introduced this year. We've had Liberty Link grown in Manitoba before, conventional Roundup Ready, and also in the future the Enlist or 2,4-D tolerant. And in this particular plot here, you'll see these dead beans through here. This is an experiment we did where we add a little bit of dicamba into our spray tank. We walked down the plot. We started spraying from this end. The booms were still filled with glyphosate. Once we got halfway down, the dicamba started to come back, come out of the booms, and then we started going down through here, and you can see how badly they kill it off. So the reason I kind of throw that picture in there, another close-up shot, is you just really need to be aware of your surroundings. Avoid drift to non-target crop is probably the biggest challenge. Things to remember about the extend system is you definitely want to be triple rinsing when you're to make sure there's no dicamba left in the tank. You want to make sure that you're, you know, pay attention to your wind speeds, not less than 3 kilometers an hour, not greater than 16 kilometers an hour, because you don't want that product moving. Definitely pay close attention to your droplet size. You want to use the largest droplet size possible to help reduce that drift. And probably the biggest key is with some of this new technology is you want to be spraying it early in the growing season to take advantage of some of that early residual control. This year, with all those percentages that we had about 3% of the acres this year that were in extending. So we'll see where that goes from there. For IDC, it's quite interesting. You know, this year it's probably a lot more pronounced than what we've seen in previous years. One of the things that we noticed, that the fact that we were so wet in 2016, we had a lot of those salts pushed close to the soil surface. This spring was terribly dry, so a lot of that moisture evaporated, left the salts behind, and made things much worse for IDC in most regions of Manitoba. So typically with IDC, you see interveinal leaf yellowing, Those veins are typically quite dark green, pretty telltale signs of IDC. In this particular variety here, this would probably score close to a 3 because of all this necrotic tissue that's showing up. So this is something that you definitely don't want to be having on a field with high carbonates and high salts. But generally, what can happen with IDC is initially it might look like an overall yellowing, but it can change very quickly to these symptoms, and that's a telltale sign that it is IDC. So, the thing with IDC, things to keep in mind, it's not going to be the same every year. Intensity, timing, longevity varies from year to year. Some years we see it for a week and it's gone, and other years it lasts for a lot longer. Usually, when it only lasts for a week, we generally get better growing conditions, maybe a little bit of rainfall, and things tend a little bit of heat, and things tend to grow out of it. Typically, at that third to second trifoliate is when you first start to see it. But in bad years like this, well, there's not much you can do about it once you see it in the field. You can plan for next year. North Dakota research suggests that if IDC persists into the fifth or sixth trifoliate, you can start to see some yield reductions at that stage. So you want to really be paying close attention to your variety selection. But one of the first things I like to do is grab your soil test. When you look at your soil test, you want to look at your soluble salts and your carbonate levels, two most important things. Now, this is from one of my fields here. My phosphate level happens to be 8 ppm. Potassium is generally quite good there. Carbonate levels, 5.9%, so that's getting into that high range. Salt levels, we're still below 1 millimoles per centimeter, but it's getting a little on the higher side, so I have to be a little careful with which varieties I put on it. We're just going to jump ahead here for a slide here. And this is this is a soybean fertility fact sheet that you can find on the Manitoba Pulse and Soybean Growers website. And this little table in here, it can be quite useful when you're picking varieties. So once you look at your soil test, look at what your carbonate level is. You know, if, for example, in this case, we were just over 5%, and then you follow down to your salt levels on the side here, well, you're at a very high risk to IDC. So in those instances, you really want to pay attention to things like things like IDC and the ratings that each variety listing that's in the guide. Now, this variety set, or the IDC trial that we have in Winnipeg, the data that you see in the guide comes from a very specific site. It's not from all our trials from all around Manitoba. We have a site in Winnipeg that's very prone to IDC, very high carbonates, very high salts. And you can see here, all these rows are actually single varieties. So we do 3 replications of each line, so each variety, and we go out over a 3-week period and we rate those varieties. This year, we were able to do it over 5 weeks because those symptoms persisted. So in the guide, you'll see the ratings listed there, but we'll go a little closer here. So what I've done here is I've just kind of pulled out the tolerant varieties. So typically anything under 1.7 is typically fairly tolerant. So those are the varieties you definitely want to be looking at if your carbonates and salts are very high. But as one person said this morning in the panel, even with some of these tolerant varieties, there are still some fields that you may not want to put soybeans on. So paying attention to your carbonates and salts. And I've had that conversation with a few growers over the last couple of days that they picked a tolerant variety, but yeah, the IDC was quite bad, and their salts were well over 11%. So that, or their carbonates were well over 11%. So also with this, you'll see that there's a variety of maturity differences between them as well. I have seen a bit of a trend towards the mid to long season varieties have a little bit better IDC scores than some of the short season varieties over the years. But again, looking at these numbers, I'm trying to pick a variety in your maturity group, but have a very good tolerance to IDC is really important. Once you start getting into that 1.8 to 2 range, then you're going to see, you might see a bit more IDC in those particular fields. Most years they grow up, but this year things might have persisted a little longer. Again, so in that 1.8 to 2.2 range is what we consider semi-tolerant, meaning that they will eventually grow out of it, but symptoms might persist longer than if the beans were tolerant. Again, here are a number of other lines here in some of the longer season categories as well. Yep. And, of course, we also have some susceptible lines. So anything rating at a 2.3 or higher, those are the varieties that you want to try to avoid on those fields with very high carbonates and salts. Sometimes even if a variety is in that approaching that 2.3 range, what you have to remember is there's 2 scores here. You have a rating and a grouping, and the rating is the rating that I give each plot over that week period. So what I do is if I have a variety that I've averaged 9 different ratings on, and it comes out to a 2.2, for example, that means there was probably some of the plots that were a little bit on the higher side. Some of those plots might have been a 2.4 or 2.5. So that's pushing that upper limit of being susceptible. And again, with we do have some long season lines here on the that are also quite tolerant as well. And on this particular slide here, I have all the tolerance, semi-tolerant, and hatchery susceptible lines. To finish off, a couple more slides here. I just want to mention that this year we might have some seed lots that are drier. So ask the question of your seed dealer when you're buying your seed: is your seed, how dry your seed is? If it's in that 9 to 10% moisture range, then you want to be prepared to ensure that you're not damaging that seed anymore. What I tend to do is, if you have a dry seed lot, take a small container of water, throw about 100 seeds in there, let them soak for 5 minutes, and watch to see if you see any seed coat separation, and count those numbers. If you see over 10%, then you want to be bumping your rate up a little bit. Things like reducing your fan speed will definitely help as well, but don't slow it down to the point of plugging your air seeder, because that's a big problem. Again, just things to keep in mind, because those hairline cracks, they don't look like much, but they generally don't produce a healthy plant. And, you know, if one of the things that Cassandra was showing, that when we, Team B, planted 150,000 plants, in 2016, when we did that, we got 110,000 plants because we got into good moisture. This year, with those plants not emerging, we didn't get that. So, and the yield was definitely reduced. So that's one thing you really need to pay attention to and just ask the question. So, to kind of finish off here, my last couple of slides here, I might go a couple minutes over, but we're going into lunch, so we should be okay. Soybean aphids. First thing I want to make, whether or not you use an insecticide seed treatment or not, you're still probably going to be scouting for soybean aphids during the growing season. Populations should be at least 250 aphids per plant and increasing before control measures are considered. The economic injury level is more like 670 aphids per plant. Spraying too early can carry off beneficials. So you don't want to be spraying too early, and you don't want to be spraying because your neighbors are. John Glavosky put together some reports for the Manitoba Insect Pest Report, and he looked back through the years on aphid pressure. So since 2001, we've only had 4 years where we've had economic high levels of soybean aphids where spraying was warranted widespread. So only 4 years in that time period. There's 2 years with moderate economic status, so where there is, you know, some localized application. And of course, in the 12 years when there were 12 years when the economic status was low, so no insecticide application was needed. And so far in all that data, we've never had 2 years in a row where we've had high levels of soybean aphids. So where I'm going with this is my next slide. So let's say that we do some quick math here. Math on 1,000 acres of soybeans. So since 2001, that's 16 years, if you had had 4 years of high aphid pressure and you would have sprayed, you'd be looking at about $16 an acre that for application and for product. That would cost you around $64,000. So since 2001, if you were to use the seed treatment, insecticide seed treatment, every year, because you assume that the seed treatment would control it, which technically it doesn't, use it every year at $7 an acre, that would cost you $112,000. And there's no guarantee you wouldn't have to add more chemical to spray it in. So I leave you those with those numbers that, you know, the nice thing about having something to spray or control measures for soybean aphids is we can go out when we need to go out and spray and know that we're going to get control. So just something to keep in mind. So just in conclusion, you know, use that maturity map as a guide to help pick your varieties. Pick varieties that are suited for your growing regions. Typically, the yields are very similar within your maturity group. You're not going to make a mistake if you pick a variety that's in your maturity group. Typically, they will yield quite well. The way you may make a mistake is if you choose a variety that has a high IBC score and you put it on a field that's quite susceptible. So if you pick a variety that has a score of 2.8 and you put it on a field with high carbonates and salts, that will run into a lot of problems for you. When you're making your decisions on varieties, try to use multiple year data. We showed that single year data, and 1 year you don't generally see a lot of difference. But when you look over multiple years, that's how you can tell how confident you're going to be on how that variety performs. So with that, I'll open up open up for any questions, but I guess that's my timeline.
Yeah, we probably have time for a question or two since it's lunchtime. We have a question from the audience. At the very top there, can you speak loud, say out?
The mic's off. Can you try that again? Available markets, as in, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Yeah, what?
Turn it on there. Okay. Yeah, maybe we'll just, if we got move, maybe I'll move up a little bit and see, because I can't quite hear you. Okay. Well, with soybeans, what we grow in Manitoba, typically 98% of our soybeans are considered GMO soybeans. So that would mean that other 2% would be considered non-GM soybeans. And there have been some markets over the years, and there are some premiums available. That you'd have to do a little bit more legwork to find out where the best market will be for that, because part of the challenge that we had when we first started growing soybeans in Manitoba back in the early 2000s was that that's what we had available, and they weren't performing well, but we were competing with Ontario for that Japanese market. And because Ontario has a freight advantage for shipping that product to Japan, that premium kind of disappeared. Saying that, there have been some companies that have had some success, and I'll just mention a couple. I know Patterson Grain has been doing some, Patterson Global Foods has been doing some non-GM products. Also, a company like Synopta has been doing some work with that as well. But you have to kind of do your research, find your market first, make sure you know where you're going to sell it, because we control, and then pick your cleaner fields. And the one challenge that some guys have as well, or farmers have, is once they go to a Roundup Ready system, it's really difficult to have both systems to keep your IP in check. So.
One more question from the audience.
Yeah. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time here today, and I'll be available here this afternoon as well if you have any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to the Manitoba Ag Days podcast. We'll see you next year from January 22nd to 24th, 2019.